bonus for those.
All right. It's technically, it's not part of the War College. It's one of our regular seminars here at Celesticon 2012. My name is Dana Lombardi, and we're doing a seminar about making and selling your board game. I have with me Frank Chadwick, a Hall of Fame designer who has done not only board games, but role-playing and other things. We have Richard Borg, who has won Game of the Year in Germany and done many famous board games. And Richard Bliss, who runs a podcast I'm going to have him tell you about and is very familiar with crowdfunding methods to get your game out there. We're going to go through this as a panel, and what I'd like to do is first ask each of you to talk about a little bit about your background and what kind of games you've done and what kind of production, starting with Frank, going to Richard Borg, and then having Richard Bliss talk about some of the business side of this, because there are practical things besides the fun part of making a game, designing it, that you have to understand if you're going to have a success. So, Frank, would you please tell us just a little bit?
Sure. I got into the game business in 1972 or 3, I forget now. It was a long time ago. A couple other friends of mine, I formed Game Designers Workshop. We didn't have any idea what the hell we were doing, but we just made it up as we went. Nobody really knew. Game production techniques were a little different back then. When we started, we basically carved our games out of big stones. It had become much more sophisticated. We had a pretty good run over 20 years. Game production right now is much more... So I did a whole bunch of games for Game Designers Workshop. Since then, I've done a lot of freelance stuff, and right now I'm doing a bunch of stuff in board games, which is what we're talking about here, for Victory Point Games, which has an entirely different production philosophy than we did. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. When I was in publishing, almost all of the actual physical production was outsourced. We were a design house. We did design and artwork, but everything else was done out of house. And Victory Point Games has an entirely different approach. Everything is done in-house. They have their own printing. It's all basically print-on-demand machinery that they actually have either own or lease, including a laser cutter for die-cut counters. They do everything physically in-house. They have actually control everything, which is, I think, a very interesting. I don't think that's typical of most publishers now, but I mean, it's certainly a different way of doing it. Most publishers still outsource the actual physical production.
And by outsource, you're talking about, for everyone's benefit, you would do the design work, you would do the play testing, you do the artwork, but then you would send out this to a printer. Find a printer who would then do, and initially, color work was very expensive, so some of the first games we did, two color was considered, pretty, sophisticated.
Yeah, it's hard to get that second color to stick to the rock.
Yes. So that's the way, the printer would do that, you'd get these games back.
And it's actually more complicated than that. You have a printer that actually does the physical printing. Then you have a die cutter who does the counters. And they mount the counters and die cut them. Then you have a box maker who actually builds the physical cardboard box. And then sometimes you have a plastics manufacturer that does the internal trays or plastic pieces. You have a whole board. So you're kind of coordinating a whole bunch
of... 4 or 5 different manufacturers.
Yeah.
Yes. And then it all got put together. And sometimes your staff would literally assemble these things back in your warehouse and send them out. That was the old way. But VPG, Victory Point Games... You're saying they don't outsource; it's all internally.
Everything is.
But that's called also desktop publishing, where because they can use their own printers internally, their own laser cutter internally, it doesn't ever go out to any other manufacturer, right?
Yeah, interesting business model.
Yes, Richard Borg, you have a background also that spans a long time, and you've worked with not only small publishers but also some of the giants in our industry.
Yeah, I'm pretty lucky. I knew Frank after he did Big Rocks. I did Littler Rock. We've been kicking around for a long time. I'm very fortunate that I started out with the JCPenney company. I worked for JCPenney's for 25 years. And the last 8 or 9 years of working at JCPenney's, being a manager and all kinds of important jobs like that, I decided that it would be more fun to go ahead and design games. Which I did. I was very successful and lucky. And success, sometimes success and luck play go hand in hand. But we created a couple games for Hasbro and did some other things like that. So today, I'm an independent game inventor. I basically invent games. That's all that I do. I'm a one-person design shop, except I think my wife would be amiss if I didn't say that she was a big part of the design process. And I have a very good group of playtesters and game guys that I game with in Orlando, Florida. And when I talk, I always talk and use the word we, because although I have to come up with the final concepts and rules and things like that, I always depend on a lot of different people for input and use their expertise and also their ideas to make a good game. I'm very fortunate that I have one game in a year in Germany, which is like a rock star here in the United States, or winning an Academy Award. So it's pretty interesting business. I actually am living the dream.
Yes, that's wonderful. Richard Bliss, before we get to you, I want to just ask one more thing, because I want to touch upon what Richard Bourne just said. Most of the game designing and manufacturing, everything really is a team effort. Yes, the designer comes up with a great idea, often has the final say in a lot of what is going to be in the game or how it works. But the fact is, without playtesters, without developers, and people don't understand what that concept is, you're giving them a raw idea in a lot of cases. And if you have to be disciplined enough to stand back and then see if they can figure it out without your help. And that often is the first crushing blow to your ego that you receive when they look at that and go, I haven't the faintest idea what you just put in front of me or what to do with it. I guess I have to go back and rethink that. So developers and playtesters are enormously important to the design and creative process, and Richard Bourne just touched upon that. I would like to now go to Richard Bliss, because Richard, tell people what your podcast does and what your background in gaming is.
Sure. Richard Bourne said he's living the dream. My podcast is called Funding the Dream. It's a podcast in the heavy listenership in the board game space. It's focused around crowdfunding Kickstarter and teaching people how to use Kickstarter to get through that process, how to set up a bank account, whether you should have an LLC. What do you do if suddenly you had $50,000 of money drop into your bank account? Now what do you do? How do you find a manufacturer? How do you find a publisher? Do you become your own publisher? These are the type of questions that I answer on my podcast. It's called Funding the Dream. My background in gaming is a gamer for many years. I don't know how to say it politely. I'm not as seasoned as the two other guys. Is that polite? Did I say that polite?
Yeah. Sure. What did he mean?
You were designing up and I was playing. That was where it was. That's my gaming background.
Yeah, ancient high school. Ancient.
Yes. My background is, I had something happen. I was at Steel. I'm in the technology space. I've traditionally been in the technology space here in Silicon Valley as a marketing executive. I was in Germany putting on a technology conference there, and by coincidence, I hadn't been paying attention to the gaming space. I just looked to see if Germany had any type of game event happening in October that maybe I could attend while I was there. And it was like, hey, look at this Spiel thing. And it was 20 minutes from my corporate offices, and it happened to be the weekend after my own conference. I was like, oh, I think I'll go. And I went as a fan, and as a fan walking into something uninitiated to Spiel and not being prepared, I've been to Comdex, I've been to very large conventions, I've never been to Spiel. I had never been and experienced anything like Spiel. And I had a cameraman with me, a buddy, we had a camera, we thought we'd just kind of document a little bit. And on the camera, after 10 minutes, I've been there 10 minutes, and I'm looking at the camera saying, I need to go outside and take a break, because it was too much to take in. It is absolutely overwhelming. It's 150,000, 125,000 board gamers playing board games, and it's very intense. But what happened was, how I ended up here, was that as my camera guy, he and I were just gamers, and I was dressed down, I was just a fan, and I happened to be at the Nexus booth. The folks that are no longer in business, they've done Wings of War, they've done War of the Ring, and they had just come out with the collector's edition of War of the Ring. It was a 3 foot tall wooden box, hand painted, $400 game. And I walked up to their booth, took some video with my flip camera, and didn't think anything about it. I had 45 seconds. Went back, posted it on BoardGameGeek, that I had this on my blog, my business blog. Went to bed, 4 hours later, woke up, and there were 2,200 hits on my blog in 4 hours from one post. And it struck me that people were looking for information. Because I wasn't reviewing the game. I was just there talking to people about it. And it struck me that the gaming industry is well served by Board Game Geek, by a tremendous amount of podcasts and reviews. And I'm not a board game reviewer, but I do know something about marketing and business and that type of thing. And so I went back to my buddy and I said, we're not going back as fans. And I went and put on my suit. He acted as a cameraman. And we went and started talking to Days of Wonder, Z-Man Games, to all these other organizations to ask them about the business of board gaming. And with that then, when Kickstarter came around a couple of years ago, I was already in that space looking at the business of board gaming, and I felt it was a natural opportunity to teach people who were interested about how now suddenly money could be put into your hands from a business side to now do what people have been doing for years. Now suddenly you can do it yourself, and it's fraught with danger and challenges.
You know, and what's interesting is that I am seasoned also. So I came from a background where I worked with a magazine called Model Retailer, which was a trade publication, and it went out to hobby shops originally. I think it still does. But at the time, they had no games at all. It was just model railroading, model airplanes, plastic model kits, all that sort of thing. And they brought me in to start writing a column about games because hobby shops try to survive. They really struggle. They're small retail operations, and so they wanted to put games in there, and I talked about SPI and other things. I became a columnist, I became a salesman, I became a publisher in the trade field, and so I got to know the business side of making games, and I got to talk with Frank and a lot of other companies out there and saw how they did it, what succeeded, what didn't. And the reason I'm bringing this up is you're talking about Kickstarter and things today that are available. Well, this is how it worked back then. I got a phone call from somebody that said, I want to buy an ad to sell my games to retail stores, both toy stores, game stores. And
my wife just walked. Oh, I need to step
okay,
out.
Okay, all right, we'll be right back. Okay. So they wanted to be able to sell their game to the trade, to game stores, toy stores, and hobby shops. And I said, well, tell me a little bit about the game. It was a science fiction game that they had come up with and so forth. And I said, well, have you done any research to find out or done any play testing or anything like that? He says, oh, no, we took our life savings and we produced these games and I have 5,000 of them in my garage and now I need to sell them. And I said, oh. I said, so, okay, all right, I'll catch up to you. How much have you put aside for advertising? Oh, we don't have any money for advertising. And I'm going, how were you going to sell these games? Oh, we thought we'd get a review in the magazines and that, you know, we would sell 5,000 copies of this. So I realized that right then, this guy had just thrown away his entire life savings for, sadly, their dream, because he didn't know all the things that were involved. And it's not just designing a game or even going out, as Frank mentioned, about getting someone to print it, assemble it, and so forth. You've got to think out the marketing and the business side. You've got to do it all, especially if you're trying to get your dream out. Or, as Richard Borg was talking about, convince a company that already has all of this distribution network and everything that your game is worth their consideration, and then keep enough of the percentage to make your fair share off of the sales. So, Richard Bliss, ironically, I mean, a lot of you may have come here because you've got a great idea, and I'm not knocking that, but if I were going to tell anybody about how to get your game published, I would start with Richard Bliss. You have to appreciate, at least understand, part of the marketing and sales behind this, without which, if you don't make it part of your plan, not just raising the money to print it or even develop or play a program, or if it's a digital game, it doesn't matter. If you don't have that aspect as part of your plan from the get-go, you're going to fail. And there's no guarantee it's going to succeed, but you're giving yourself much better odds if you do that. So, Richard, I want to work backwards this time through the group, and I want to ask you, and I'm not trying to be mean, okay, to anyone out there, but I just told a story about somebody that really failed big time. It was a terrible, terrible thing, and I feel sad for the people, but I couldn't do anything other than listen to the train wreck because I knew what was coming. Do you have an example of something like that, or a very positive example in your experience that you can relate that would be...
I ran out, so...
I'm sorry. I gave a story about somebody had spent their life savings producing a game, putting it in their garage, and they had no money for advertising and didn't think beyond just getting it in the garage. And, of course, they lost their life savings. Those games eventually just went to a landfill. They could never move them, and that was it. It was a disaster because they had not thought of the sales side of it.
Well, we've heard so many of those stories, right? We all know that person. Right, whoever it is, we all know somebody just like that. That game sits in the closet somewhere. No, it's not the closet. They don't have enough closet space.
No, attic, garage.
They're lucky if all it is an idea they spent time on. What the ones that are the disasters are truly the ones where they spend a lot of money to produce it, and then they haven't thought about how they're going to distribute it, market it, and so forth.
Distribute, market it, or even think through the whole process. As Frank's talking about in-house production. So many of us don't know that when we see, if you've been out on Kickstarter and you see somebody who's raised $50,000 for a project, you're thinking, wow, right? I might be able to live on that. Okay? What you don't see is that it might have cost them, so now they raised all this money, and we call it the worst case success. And what that means is that you say, hey, if you back my crowdfunding project, I'll give you a t-shirt, I'll give you a copy of the game, I'll throw this in. You know, how much does it cost to ship a game?
$15
$15.
Okay.
Let's take
$10.85 priority mail.
So we're going to do, I like his answer better because it's easier math. Okay? So $10 to ship a game. So you think about it. You put a game on Kickstarter and you're like, I'm going to ship you the game. And Kickstarter says, hey, look, you got to include the shipping's got to be included at the pledge level.
Right.
You're like, oh, okay. So if you give me $25, I'll send you a copy of my game and I'll ship it to you. Oh, and you know what? If you give me $35, I'll toss in a t-shirt. And if you give me this much, I'll do this. Suddenly, you raise this money, and you get 1,000 people to back you. Well, how much shipping is that?
$10,000.
There's $10,000. So if you get 1,000 people who gave you $25 each, that's $25,000, right? That's a lot of money. Except for 10,000 of it just went to shipping. You're now left with 15,000. And that 15,000 is, you included a t-shirt? How much does a t-shirt cost?
$16 after printing.
You got it now?
Full color.
Full color, and people usually get a little creative. I'm going to make this really nice t-shirt. The worst case success is you successfully reach your funding goal on a project, and now it costs you so much money to produce what you promised that it costs you more money out of your pocket to produce this thing, then you're worse off than when you started, and you still haven't even made the game yet, right? And so that's some of the things that we see right now with the uninitiated who are getting all excited. They put the idea up. They don't think through this process. They suddenly raise all this money, and now they owe so much, and you haven't even made the product. You haven't even gotten to find out how much this thing costs to make. So that's some of the just... anecdotal, some of the stories that we're finding and encountering out there.
Exactly. Richard Borg, you didn't go through that version of it. You've always sold your games to another publisher, correct?
The first game we did, actually, we produced ourselves, but by today's standard, it was kind of pretty remedial and stuff. It's not... We took an old recipe box, we put some dice in a cup, and went to Gen Con and said, we can sell this thing. And that wasn't very smart either, but you know, we thought we had a product that was interesting. And fortunately for myself and my family is that a gentleman from Milton Bradley at the time was at that convention and saw the game and took it back to Milton Bradley, and actually they licensed it from us. Otherwise, we would have had 500 copies of the game in the garage, and because we only sold 3 copies at Gen Con, so it's
and
like
one of us the Milton Bradley. That's all.
Well, no, we gave them a couple. We actually just gave them a couple, so which was a good thing. So production or cost wise and production wise and stuff, we were lucky that we didn't invest, you know, our life savings in that product. So in by the grace of God, I mean, things worked out that we didn't have to go down that road. But since then, I actually made a vow to myself and my wife. I said I would never risk our savings or our life savings on any game we design. And I always go and try to license a game product to a company, because if you license it to a company, you're not going to get wealthy as a game company, because the game company wants to make money too. But I make my 2 to 5 to 10%, depending on what the product is and what the licenses are. And I've been very fortunate since then that companies have come to me, and I don't have to do it speculatively anymore. Companies actually come to me and say, hey, do you want to do a game, or can you do a game about? And so that's been, you know, pretty lucky.
So you're saying basically that while genius is absolutely critical, luck trumps everything.
Right? Luck trumps everything.
So that's it. The seminar is over. Just everyone go get lucky. Okay?
Yeah, that's right.
That's it. That's all you have to do. Frank?
Yeah, there's actually a line in the musical Pepin. Pepin, I don't know if any of you remember that from years and years ago, but his father, Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, is giving him advice, and he sings a song that says, it's smarter to be lucky than it's lucky to be smart.
There you go. That's right.
So what was the question? What am I supposed to do?
We were talking about positions where people have put themselves into, that Richard was saying that, you know, the success looked like success on paper, and then it ended up costing him more. And
sure.
Richard Ward was saying that even his first experience was the actual game was a disaster, except
right.
that Milton Bradley, thank God, was there. So, you know, in the early days of, like, for example, GDW, I mean,
we were pretty lucky. I mean, we kind of blundered into a reasonable price point, and we had some pretty good printers right off the bat, and we got a good die cutter right off the bat, and we never, you know, lost money on a game. And the first games we did made enough money that they kind of we had basically no capital. I mean, we had sweat equity and a couple $1,000 each, but you know, that was enough to get the first game. And the first game made enough money that it really financed the next game and some a little bit more,
kept
and it
going.
Just and it kept going. And if the first game had stumbled, if the first game had been a disaster, no one here would ever have heard of the Game Designers Workshop.
You're done.
That's
you're
it.
Done. You're basically
That's it. But,
done.
But by the grace of God, you know, or just dumb luck, you know, the gods rolled the dice, and we came up with a pretty good number. So we never had that problem, and you kind of saw it a lot in the game industry at the time, where, you know, little companies would come up. Somebody once kind of uncharitably called them Mayfly companies, because they last a season, and that's it. And they kind of show up with their stuff that they've, you know, gotten, and you'd look at their games and kind of wonder. Oh, there was a company called Taurus Enterprises. You don't remember?
Oh my God!
Remember that? Remember them?
Whoa,
boy, were they weird!
Oh.
But
to use that term in this industry,
oh, I know.
That must really be weird.
Oh, they were. Yeah.
They were weird.
Well, it's a little like a relative of Attila the Hun. And the Huns all practiced ritual scarification of the cheeks, and they misshaped their head, and they were all bow-legged and everything. And this relative of it was called Mudzug the Ugly. What must he have looked like if the Huns thought he was ugly? So, yeah, what must this company have been like if I think it was weird? But, it's way up there. You'd see a lot of things where you spent a lot of time thinking about presentation and packaging and how to present them, and then people would show up thinking that like stuff stuck to a box would appeal to people. You know, people that don't, you know, kind of just didn't do the basic thinking about what looked like a professional presentation, what would make customers confident that what was inside the box was worth having based upon what the box looked like. Or you know, when they look at the when they do open the box and look at the components, they go, ah! They recoil in horror. You know, no, there's a really good game in here. Okay,
I'll believe you.
Yeah,
please go away.
So yeah, I mean, there's lots of companies that came on very quickly in the game business because they didn't understand. And we, like I said, we stumbled into it. It's not like we had any expertise in this. We just kind of. Sometimes if you have a passion for gaming and you look at games and you say, "Boy, I love that game because of the way it looks and everything," then you kind of try to do something that has that look. But if you don't pay attention to that stuff as to what the customer wants and what will appeal to the customer and how to get that in front of the customer to appeal to them, then you're probably out of luck.
Well, I would like to do the following now. I mean, we could go and do lots of anecdotes, which would be entertaining on one level, but I think that everyone who came here, because some of you have some specific questions about either designing or creating or selling, marketing, and so forth. So what I'd like to do is open it up to questions from the audience. You could direct it to a particular person here or just to the panel in general, and then we could answer your questions. So is there anybody that has a specific question right now that you'd like to ask?
All right, there's a couple things about game design that I'll share with you. One of the anecdotes that I like, and it wasn't mine, this is a good anecdote, is there's a very smart game designer told me once that design a game where the players, or where the game ends before the players want to quit. And that's so true. I mean, sometimes you play a game and you're going, hey, this is really fun, but after a while it says, well, hey, this is getting kind of boring. So try to design, if you're working on a game or working on a project, work on something that will actually engage the players and they're ready to keep playing, but the game will actually end. And then they go, oh, well, that was great. Let's play again. So. And a lot of the games that I design, and if you're familiar with some of the games that I've worked on and stuff, they're shorter games. They're not long games. I mean, Frank and I played Dragnet Ghosten and some of those games years ago, and it took a whole weekend to play. That's what happens with seasoned gamers.
Yes.
We carved out that whole, hey, dear, we're going to play, and we will see you on Monday when I got to go to work. And so that's the games we played. Mm-hmm. But, things have changed so fast in our society and stuff like that, that if you can play a game in an hour and a half, you can play two games if you want. Besides that, you don't have a lot of energy and invested in a game that even if you lose, there's some kind of like, but if you win or lose or whatever, you're ready to play again and maybe you can beat them the next time. So that's just a philosophy that I'm trying to do in a lot of my games. So Frank also, you know, we go back and our seasoned guys, basically, us seasoned guys, basically, when Frank was designing and doing a lot of games, you got to remember the games that he was producing were under $10 a lot of times.
Yeah, they were.
And so, but
now, they wouldn't be today.
But by today's standards, you're talking about a whole different thing. Now you're talking about games that are $60, $70, $100 out there. But today, I mean, years ago, we were designing games that basically sold for $9.99. You know, I get 5% of $9.99. Well, that game cost $1 to maybe make, so I get a 5 cents or something like that. But by today's standards, you're talking about $60, $100 games. But the game components and everything has changed. Everything looks 10 times better than what we... I mean, even your stuff was not that super duper by the standards of the day. It was great.
It's amazing to go back and look at things like Dragnet Ghosten, the first game we ever did, which was under $20. It was 5 full size maps. It was over 1,000 counters. It was under $20. It had a 2-color map, and it had a couple of the counter sheets actually had like 3 or 4 colors on them. And it was the thing that sold it was graphically a quantum leap above what was out there at the time.
Sure.
One of the things that, and so now I will share a little piece of advice, and that is one of the things when you're doing a game, particularly if you're going to do a big game that you think is going to be a big hit, you better think about the fact that you can't get much gold out of the same hill where people have already been mining for years. You can't just go out there and do a game just like everybody else has done and expect it to be a big breakout hit. There's got to be something unique and something special about it that makes people value that game in a special sort of way. I mean, our early games were graphically primitive by today's standards, but they were still, like I said, a quantum leap above what was generally available.
Sure. That's it.
You kind of have to think of some way that you're going to set yourself apart. A really good friend of mine in the gaming industry once said, nobody ever got rich selling turkeys. People got rich selling butterball turkeys. You know, selling something that had a unique sense of that made it special and a higher quality. That was Greg Scott.
No!
GHQ said that.
There you go.
Well, Richard Bliss, I'm going to go back. I have to do this because they have two Richards here. So, Richard Bliss, you've said that you're concentrating on board games today because that's part of this.
Yep.
But within your experience, you're dealing with people who do like miniatures and other
types
of
games.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the whole tabletop gaming. RPGs do very well on crowdfunding. The miniatures, if you're following crowdfunding at all, the miniatures are doing incredibly well, and it's going to go to what Frank just said, and that is it's unique. Just like there was a magnitude of difference with the artwork. Today, if you got on a crowdfunding site like Kickstarter and you look at backing a miniatures project, you're going to end up at the end of the day with so much stuff for the amount of money that you gave. It boggles the mind because it's almost impossible for you to walk into a game store and buy that. But if you go to a crowdfunding site, so what I'm talking about, to elaborate on it, is that these miniature projects, what they're doing is they're finding they said, if you'll give us a minimum amount of money, we pay. Miniatures are lopsided. There's huge upfront costs, and then ongoing costs are this big.
Yeah.
It's the mold. You gotta make the mold. You gotta sculpt the mold. You gotta produce the mold. Pumping out 1,000 little plastic figs doesn't cost anything. I mean, a few cents. Mm-hmm. And so what these projects are doing, this is what's setting them apart and making them unique, is they're saying, look, if you'll give us $100 right now to back our project, as we continue to make more and more money, we'll just keep giving you more figs for free. So that encourages people early on to jump on board and hand their $100 over, because now, the longer they've been on, more figs. And suddenly, you'll end up with a game like Zombicide out there, and then we're talking about the
Reaper.
They're just giving, it looks like, traditionally, they're just giving away the farm because we're so used to retail pricing. They're not paying retail price to give you that stuff. They're not even paying wholesale price. They're paying cost to them for these tiny little figs, yet you're still giving them all this money. They could keep giving you figs all day long, and that's causing then this huge surge of money and interest around figures. So if you want to be successful today, it was artwork before. Today, two things will make you successful with your game. Put figures in it and make it about zombies. Those are the two things that you're going to guarantee success.
So there you go. Yes, Roger.
I have a question on crossover. I work in the video game industry, and a lot of successful video games have come from board miniature games, and vice versa. Some successful video games have gone to tabletop. World of Warcraft would be a good example of that. So how do you convince these video game companies that making a tabletop game of their video game would be a good idea?
Frank?
I don't know. I'm not actually, unless you're talking about a specific game, I'm not sure it would be a good idea.
Okay, well,
you know, I mean, they, because there's times when it wouldn't be a particularly good idea, it seems to me.
My example is World of Tanks. Uh-huh. We have 10 million registered players worldwide.
And the first question I guess I would ask is, you're probably not going to go after the 10 million registered users because they've already got the game they like, which is the online gaming experience. I mean, they're not going to want the tabletop game. The question is, how can you get the appeal of the table of the online gaming experience on a tabletop so you'll attract tabletop players to it? And not knowing much about the game in question, I mean, that would be the way you'd have to approach it. You know, how can we take the appeal of this online game and turn it into a mechanism that will appeal to tabletop players? That would be one way to do it. An easier way to do it would be to just point to these numbers and say, look, guys who do figures are selling boatloads of this stuff in crowdsourcing, so, connect the dots, pal,
Toys sell.
Yeah. But you could also even experiment with them. You could go to them and say, let me do an experiment. I'll give you an example. Tammany Hall just was on Kickstarter. A game that's not that old, but it went out of print. And a guy who really, really liked it, he's a financial planner, really liked it, just on a whim, emailed the intellectual property holder of the game. I'd like to take this to Kickstarter. Would you let me? Now, the publisher had already decided that they couldn't figure out how to get this game back into print because of upfront costs. The intellectual property holder went to the publisher and said, hey, this guy wants to put it on Kickstarter. What do you think? And they're like, we have nothing to lose. Go ahead, let him do it. $150,000 later, Tammany Hall becomes one of the top Kickstarter board games. The reason I'm using this example is because everybody along the line, sure, they were like, okay, whatever. They didn't really care because there was no risk. And yet somebody with passion was able to go out and now there's no question. So when he came back and said, well, I'd like to do another one, okay. To answer your question, to go and say, I'd like to kickstart a line of tanks specifically for our game. You don't even have to put a game with it. I would recommend to put a game with it, but you say, I'm just going to do a line of tanks miniatures. And it's going to be plastic, right? So you don't want to get in the pewter or anything like that. Just plastic tanks that are around our line. And we think, find a molder, injection molding company, and it's going to cost us probably $10,000. Go to the company and say, would you, if I do this, would you allow me to at least to use the license to do the tanks? They're like, okay, because if it fails, nobody's out anything. Right. If it succeeds, they win. Because now the next time you go and ask to do it, they're going to say, yeah, and here's how much cut we're going to take. And so that's how I would recommend that you do something like that. You start with, Kickstarter projects are all about breaking it down into the smallest viable piece that you can have success around. Rather than trying to do the whole thing, just find one little piece and let that feed the success.
How many people here have supported any kind of a Kickstarter or crowdfunding? How many people here have done?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, huh?
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Were these game items or are other types of things? All games?
Games and other.
Games, okay. Yeah. All right. Because Kickstarter is also good for publishing and for other things, but...
It is. It's great for all kinds of things. So Kickstarter, let's do a quick explanation of what it is. It's a crowdfunding site that allows you to take your idea, whatever it might be, a passion, and it has to be basically a tangible thing, but that it's not even really tangible. It has to be a project, a beginning, a middle, and an end with something deliverable at the end. It can't be, I want you to fund my vacation or I want to start a business. No, I'm going to do something. You put it up there, and then people give you money, and then you give them something in exchange. What you give in exchange is kind of like a PBS television pledge station. If you give us $25, we'll send you a hat. Right? So a film. Kickstarter started off with film and music. If you give us $25 for us to do our film, we will put you in the credits. If you give us $100, we will name one of the characters after you. If you give us $5,000, we'll actually put you in the movie. And guess what? People pay $5,000 to get in a movie. Books, film, music, games, comics, food. I have backed a Mexican farm in New Jersey that raises native herbs from Mexico to be sold in the New York farmers market. They decided they want to do this little farm. The guy comes up from Mexico every year and grow herbs that they can sell locally to all the Mexican sure. families in New York. they needed $5,000. Sure, here's $10. And I got, for my $10, I think they even sent me a packet of seeds and said, thank you. And that's all I got for my $10. And they reached their 5,000 goal. And so you can do a whole wide range of different projects that are out there. And that's the way it works.
Yeah, I've supported an author friend of mine, and his lowest version was $5, you get nothing, you know, except for his thanks. And I said, what the heck, you know. He said, buddy, here's $5, good luck. And but I keep getting his updates and so forth, so I'm tuned into what's going on. But yeah, I mean, you don't have to necessarily give anything at all, depending on what the level is, if you start out something like that. What you were saying, though, last night when we were talking about this is that fear stops most people. I would say ignorance. You know, it's like, I don't know how to do this, or I'm worried that if I do it wrong, I've really blown an opportunity. I've jeopardized something, and that stops you because it's like, oh, I want to make sure all the, you know, T's are crossed and right. the I's are dotted before I go and launch this thing. But you were saying that's not necessarily what you have to
not
do to
all.
Get this. So can you elaborate on that?
How many of you would be interested in putting a project on, having it crowdfunded and have people give you $10,000? Is there anybody here who would be interested in that? All right, there's a few people. All right. Is there anybody here who has actually put a project on a crowdfunding site? Yeah, what did you put up there?
Cowtown.
Cowtown? Really? Okay. So, there's nothing stopping you right now from taking your project and putting it up there. And so what I was telling Dana was that fear sometimes, that you're afraid of screwing it up, getting it wrong. It's really, really hard to get it wrong. Define what your idea is, define what you want to do, how you want to craft it, and then you stick it up there. If you get it wrong, they'll come back and say, you got it wrong, try again. If you put your project up there and it fails to actually reach your funding goal, nothing bad happens. You get to simply retool it and hit the launch button again and keep launching that, keep launching it, and keep launching it until you get it right.
I'd like to clarify what you just said, because you started out by talking about the successful failure or the catastrophic
worst
success.
Case success, so, yes.
Yeah. I think what people need to hear is not if you fail to meet the threshold, but it's self-correcting, no money out. It's when you get a bullet through the head up here is what people need, because that's where people's fear is coming from.
There's lots of fears coming from too much money, what do I do, now what do? I've got all these games, I've got all this money. There's all kinds of things that come up.
And you have an obligation, obviously, to give the people, you know.
No.
There is no obligation.
You get the money and you don't...
There is no
I need to do this so badly.
There is no contractual obligation. There is no contractual obligation that says you have to fulfill your promise.
So anything you said about how I now have to spend $10,000 on postage is only if you're an honest guy.
That's right. Correct.
You can walk away from the whole project.
You can take the money
and
help. You can walk away from
you
the,
walk,
you
walk
can
away
take
from
the project.
The whole thing.
I refer to crowdfunding as the monetization of reputation. I am going to take my reputation and find out how much it's worth. And then, once I find out how much it's worth and I get that worth, you can do that once, right? We all know the, you know, fool me once. George Bush said it famously. I won't repeat his famous way he said it. But
we won't get fooled again. Yeah.
You don't, if you want to keep doing it, and so the person that Dana's referring to launched 4 Kickstarter projects this year. He has raised $60,000 on 4 projects. He's writing books. Well, what are his costs to produce those books?
Time.
And so he has asked people, if you give me money, I will crank out 12 books this year. And it's $60,000 later, he's in the process of cranking out 12 books. At the end of the first one, and I've heard several people talking about this guy, because they're his books. The first set of books are starting to arrive. People are getting in their hands. He now says, I'm launching another one. I'm going to write some more books. Anybody want to back me? The people who just got the books are like, yeah, I'll back you. But the first time you get burned, then you're like, that person's asking for more money. I'm not going to give them any more money.
Right, but what I'm saying is, you opened your premise by saying there's this big danger. Here's where you can get hit, is if you haven't thought it all the way
through. Yeah, I mean, I paid attention.
This guy's out. And then you were just saying now, oh, it's really easy. You can't fail. It's self-correcting. And there's a dichotomy in there that I think you need to clarify.
You can't, right. So when we're talking about this fear of failure, you're afraid that one of the things that's holding you back is that you are emotionally connected to your project. And when you put it out there, you are asking strangers to judge you with money and your personal self-worth that's tied to this project. Now, I'm speaking a bit rhetorical, but I'm also speaking very right to your heart, because I have talked to a lot of people, and I've been there myself. When you put that project out there that you believe in and you've worked on for so long, and it gets rejected, we all know, no matter how many times you send a game idea to somebody and they say no, no matter how many successes you've had, it's got to hurt a little bit. Well, maybe not.
I have a lot of failures, too. I mean, I've got as many games that I've sold, but I got double that what I haven't sold, so it happens. I think one of the big opportunities with a Kickstarter is not so much even for you guys to go ahead and say, I'm going to take that leap, I want to do that myself, because doing it yourself is still kind of self-production. You're producing the game yourself. But where the big opportunity is, if you have a game that's worthwhile and you really believe in it, there's a lot of companies out there now that are looking for a project, and there's no risk for them anymore to say, oh, your game is pretty good, I'll go ahead and put it on Kickstarter and go ahead and do the artwork and do all that stuff. For that's a little expense for them. But if it's successful, they're going to give you a contract, or they give you a contract ahead of time. And if it doesn't finance, or it doesn't come
fund,
through,
right.
If it doesn't fund, you know, they're not really out anything, and the whole thing just kind of goes away. But the opportunities for us as game designers or potential game designers is that you guys can go ahead and talk to these companies, and they're more willing to talk to you. Now, you're not going to talk to a Hasbro, you're not going to talk to Mattel or any of those bigger companies, because they're not on that project yet. But someday they will be. But the mid-level or even some of the smaller companies are doing this now. That's what Cowtown was. It's a game that I gave to a company I didn't even know that was going to be on Kickstarter, and it went to Kickstarter, it funded, and these companies are actually putting money behind it. Even though it was a low volume amount of money that they were asking for, they were going to produce it anyway. But because now they're willing to take a look at some other games that are just kind of games that I have in my attic that haven't sold prior, but they'll put them up there, and if they can get the funding, basically it's paid for their production cost, and they basically get the games to sell then later. So and I think the companies that are doing that, the Reapers, the Steve Jackson Games, and some of these bigger companies, it's going to be a way that they're going to put more product out there. I mean, Frank, you have a lot of games in your library of games. I don't know, you know, some of the games that you probably produced years ago probably could be relaunched on Kickstarter and be successful. I mean, when Ogre hit whatever amount of money they did.
Well, they get $250,000 on you, Ogre, I think.
987,000.
Oh, I was something else that did $250,000. They did better than that. Huh?
You know, Traveler was put up there. It did very well.
Yep.
Ace of Aces did very well.
There's some of these old games that basically are revived. They're revitalizing, but there's also an opportunity for a lot of new stuff to come there. But I think the main problem with Kickstarter right now is there's so much stuff coming on, it's hard to even keep up with what's coming on. So,
in the old days of Kickstarter, if you put a project up there, and old days was last year, so last year at this time, if you put a project on Kickstarter, the novelty was enough to drive interest. That doesn't work anymore. If you put a project up there and you don't, as Dana was saying earlier, if you don't put thought and attention into building a community before the project goes up, you have to have fans before you put it up there. You have to have people interested in it. And I use a rough number, it's a rule of thumb, 5%. 5 to 10% of your network is what you can expect to get funded out of your project. 5 to 10% of your network. And what I mean by that is, how many people do you know How many Facebook friends do you have? How many LinkedIn or Twitter? How many email addresses do you have? How many people do you know in your database? Whatever. 5 to 10%, and the average, the most common pledge on Kickstarter is $25. So now take the number of people you know. I know 1,000 people, all right? 50 of them are gonna give you $25. That's how much your network's worth. That's not a lot of money. But that's one way to start thinking about, if I wanna put this project out there, how do I do it?
I've seen advertising, for example, on BoardGameGeek, where it says, it's a Kickstarter project, help us fund this game. And out of curiosity, there'll be people that will be driven to it just to see what that's all about. So there's actually an advertising and marketing cost to help build your Kickstarter. So it's not like free, you can do that. But like you just said, if you're just gonna rely on the people that you know, you're only gonna be able to get so many of those people, plus because there's so many Kickstarter things going on, you may be lost in the crowd.
It's interesting, Kickstarter didn't know about that. Kickstarter launched for film and music. Then they started looking at their own data and they started realizing that 10% of their visitors came from this site called BoardGameGeek. And they didn't quite know what that was.
Oh, man.
So, and you gotta realize that Kickstarter last year made up 2%, board gamers made up 2% of the funding on Kickstarter. 2%. Yet they were in the top 10 referring sites of visitors to Kickstarter last year. So they went to BoardGameGeek and like, what is this thing? And then they saw for the very first time people were running ads on BoardGameGeek. That was the first time it ever happened for a Kickstarter project. Now, you drive up on the peninsula and you'll see Pebble, which raised $10 million on Kickstarter, is taking out full billboard ads on the side of 101 to tell you about their Kickstarter project. But it was the board game space that did it first. Stretch goals. If you hit your funding and I get $10,000 and I still have 3 weeks to go, now what do I do? Well, I'll add a stretch goal. If we raise some more money, I'll add something in. Stretch goals had never occurred to the Kickstarter people until they saw it happening in the board game space. They never realized what this, because board games were unique, or kind of unique, in Kickstarter. Up until the board game became heavily, it was all about film and music. You back my music, okay, well, I'll send you a CD. But it became more about the emotional buy-in. But with games, it's, if you back my project, I will give you the game. And this pre-order system, as more and more people are looking at Kickstarter, was introduced also by the board game space. And so it's been a very eye-opening experience for Kickstarter themselves to watch the board game industry driving. It's not just the board game, it's the video game space as well. So right this weekend, PAX Prime in Seattle is going on right now, the largest video game and board game convention. And Kickstarter is there in a big way because, as Roger was saying, there's this crossover happening. Books, comics, board games, video. The people who backed a board game will probably back the video game, and they'll back the comic book, and they'll back the RPG, and they'll back the things. And you've started to monetize in a way that you couldn't do before. But it's putting interesting challenges and opportunities for established board game producers.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
No, sorry, I didn't.
An opportunity.
No, no, that's great.
It's big opportunities.
You had a question.
Yes. It's sort of a follow on. One of the things that's sort of a landmine in the sort of the crossover market is like Games Workshop, for example. They did computer game editions of some of their board games. So they had the Blood Bowl computer game and the Space Hulk computer game. And it turns out these killed their sales, because it was cheaper to play the computer game because you didn't have to pay for all the miniatures to play the game. And it was the same mechanical game. So they ended up, I was working for a company that was doing licensed work for SSI, and we got a contract to do the Epic 40K computer game, but they wouldn't let us see the rules. Because they were adamant that we would never be able to create a game that was similar or identical to the board game, because they didn't want it to be a viable option for the miniatures players. They had to have this firewall. Mm-hmm. They were changing the rule set at the time, but they wouldn't let us see the rules. So sometimes there's this danger where crossover can end up hurting the parent company.
Competing with yourself.
Yeah, they ended up killing their own, you know.
Although, Richard, you can address, you've talked to Days of Wonder a little bit.
Yeah. The, you know, that's always something that was in the back of my mind, too. If you sell it online, are you going to keep selling the board game? And, you know, I was kind of leery about that myself. But today, I think the online play is actually helping the board game sales of Memoir 44. It's exactly the same game.
But the buy-in on Memoir 44 is so much lower than the buy-in on the load of stuff you need to play, like Blood's Hole or...
Sure.
Yeah, and that's
sure.
Probably...
Yeah, if you have to invest hundreds and hundreds of dollars into something, right. Or you play a game for $20 online, then
right.
Obviously there's a huge difference as opposed to a board game that's going to be a $40, $50 game.
Right.
Roger, I want to go back. You actually brought up a good point about the board game, and Frank was saying, well, you know, what's the value to the company? Actually, there is a way to do a board game for World of Tanks that makes sense for the company, and it's this. You know, any way you can squeeze another dollar out of an existing customer, right? Whether you sell them a hat, a t-shirt, or something that's unique.
It could probably be phrased more gently.
we're not recording this, so we won't
yes,
tell.
Exactly. a way to encourage people to support you better than they already are is to offer them other things, right? Things that are fun and interesting and so forth. Well, besides the models, which would appeal to their own customers, is if you had a board game, there are some people that are just collectors that would just try it because it's unique and different. Again, it has value, and if they recognize that, suddenly you're getting, if you sell none of them to anybody other than your own 10,000 worldwide customers, and you sell 1,000 games, maybe that's not a hit by, say, an independent game standard, and it may not be a lot of money, but it's like, if it didn't cost you anything, you know, and you sell 1,000 copies of a game you're charging, say, $30 for, you just got $30,000 more out of your customers.
One point I would add with that is also the game or the product that you're offering to your players, you give something with that has value in the game. So they get
If you tie that into the online game, all of a sudden it's like, I want it because I want it. Especially if, say, that is unique. Every 13th box or every 50th item that's sold is like, it's just, you know, there's all kinds of ways to do that, and then it gets very sophisticated in the marketing. I'm sure they've done studies about coupons and everything else that you can do, but it's very sophisticated and it can be very complicated, and again, it's like, it's sometimes it's overwhelming, and if you're not familiar with it, if that's not something that you think about normally, and designing a game is just one tiny block in what we're talking about, because it's just a whole matrix of design, development, playtesting, graphics, art, production, market, research. It's like all the
distribution, fulfillment,
distress, right? Support. You know, what is your consumer satisfaction going to be to keep them doing this? Do you design a game that's it, one game, it's the end of it, or do you design a game that you intentionally plan to have more expansions, extra card packs that will come in later? I mean, as a matter of fact, when I'm working on a game now, I already have the expansions designed, you know, because you don't wait to see what happens, you have them done so that those can come out in a reasonable amount of time, because if you want to keep it going and keep people's interest, you have to have something available pretty quickly, and the only way to do that is to have it pre-designed and pre-ready. I mean, there's a lot of levels. Like I said, that one block of design, no matter if that's the big joy and fun, is just surrounded by many blocks of other things that are equally important.
If you have a game design that you want to get to market, Richard and Frank have both touched on this, and that is the market is very, very similar to the way it was, as Frank was describing it, in the early days. There are new game publishers, and they are. Richard Borg and I were just at Gen Con talking about the term you just used. We didn't use that term, but it's very applicable, and that is the Mayfly games. And that is these game companies that pop up, and the next year they're not going to be here. Mm-hmm. But, as you said, they're doing it anyway, and they're stumbling into it, just like you guys did, and what's going to happen is a few of these are going to find success. And what's happening is there's so much money pouring into it right now. Every day, there's a new game publisher out there. And they put their project up on Kickstarter, or they do it, and they're hungry for new stuff. Because now they're in the middle of this, and they got this process going, and they want to feed the beast. And the good news for you is if you have a game idea or a game design that you want to take, there are this plethora of new publishers that are popping up every day. Now, they might come and go on your game, but you will learn the process, you'll get it out there, and every once in a while you might get lucky and have a piece of cardboard in a cereal box and Hasbro might buy it.
The thing to remember about mayflies is the only reason that there are any is because last year's mayflies mated and laid eggs. And these are the direct results of the mayflies.
That's an interesting way to think about it.
Last year's mayfly laid an egg.
Again, I want to just say one thing. We talk about Kickstarter and the opportunities are there for you with Kickstarter and to do your own thing. But first of all, I'm going to have to say, don't quit your day job. I mean, I've always said that to people that are looking to design their own games. Don't quit your day job. Don't get a garage full of 5,000 copies of some game. Kickstarter is going to give you a break if you're actually going to go down that road. I would also recommend that before you try to do something on your own, because it's a monumental task, it really is, to deal with everything that you have to deal, get your game, make a prototype of it, play it, get it all working, and then go show it to somebody else first. Show it to game companies, because that's going to be your easiest way to sell your first game. They're going to take their experience, is going to take your product, your idea, your prototype, and they might put it on Kickstarter. They might say, hey, this is the greatest game ever. I don't have to put it on Kickstarter. I know I'm going to back this thing with 5,000 copies, or I'm going to print a couple thousand copies. And it's going to sell because it is a very good game. But personally, I would recommend you don't do it on yourself because it's just too much work. If it was simple, I would be on Kickstarter with all the crap that I got in my attic. And it's not that simple because I don't want to do the artwork. I don't want to do the inventory. I don't want to do the billing. I don't want to do all the stuff that you have to do on Kickstarter. That's not why I was in business. That's not why I want to. It's an opportunity if you have the guts, you have had the glory, you can gain the glory, but it's a very difficult one because it's just like self-publishing. So that's just my opinion.
Right. It shouldn't be, if you don't want to be an entrepreneur, you know, if you just want to be a game designer, be a game designer. Find someone to be the entrepreneur. I mean, Kickstarter is just a capital resource for entrepreneurs.
Right.
It doesn't change the physics of producing
that's
the game.
That's right.
What you have
you
to do.
You have to have a good game. Uh-huh. You have to have good artwork. Yep, you got all that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I asked Z-Man Games, Zev, why he didn't produce a bunch of these Kickstarter projects that were being very successful. This was about over Easter weekend I saw him. And he said, you know what? And I made this list. You know, why didn't you publish these? Look how successful they are. He said, not a single one of those people came to me and pitched their game.
Wow.
No, they didn't even bother. They didn't even just ask. And so as Richard's saying, as Frank's saying, is that it doesn't hurt. Rejection's not necessarily a bad thing. It hurts, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily a bad thing. See, send it to one of these guys who've already got all the work done.
And I'll also tell you, the thing of it is, if you're a good listener, you can go into a company and you basically find out as you play the game with them, or you have the opportunity, and a lot of times you don't even have an opportunity to play it with them. But as you play it, they'll make suggestions, and sometimes you can take those suggestions and build them into your game, or when you're showing somebody else, or even re-show them. And you're also going to get familiar with what that company is looking for, what they like to see in a game, what they like to do. And so, again, you're going to work with the mid-level companies, but the mid-level companies are making lots of money too. So you're not going to get rich on your first game. Hopefully you will, but you know, maybe it'll be Magic the Gathering, or maybe it'll be Ticket to Ride, or maybe it'll be some game like that. But you know, I hope and pray that it is successful for you like that. But you're going to probably have a lot of games that, you know, if you make $200, you know, hey, I made $200 on it. It's the love of doing a game and then do another game and do another one. So.
And I think we've just run out of time for the seminar, but one last question, a couple last questions. Anybody?
Like when you go pitch an idea to a company, what about the intellectual property? Like the, you know, I'm a little protective of some ideas still, but I heard it's not just trying to protect them. I mean, just put out.
Most of the companies, and I've been doing this for a few years, and Frank might be able to tell you how they worked and stuff, but most of the companies that you work with are very reputable companies. I mean, if you're working with the mid-tier or the some of the bigger companies, and even some of the smaller companies, they don't want to really steal your idea. They want your idea because if it's a good idea, they want to produce it and make money just like you, and they will give you a fair share of what that money is. There's instances that I can cite even in my career that I show something and, you know, it's very close to somebody else's idea or they already bring something out and I go, hey, well, that was similar to what I just showed you. But I'll relate a story to you. I had a game and I went into Hasbro and I showed them this game in New York Toy Fair. I played the game with them. They said, hey, this is really great. It was called Sounds Like or something. I can't even remember what the name of the guy. The guy that I'm showing the game to gets up, goes into this other room, brings a game back, Sounds Like. Same name. He says, this game plays just like you just said. And he goes, but your game does this and this and this, which is better than what that game does. And so they said, so we'll call that inventor and we'll see whether we can cooperate on the two. Well, they never did the game anyway, but that's beside the point. But it's so interesting that we're all triggered by the same stimuli. You know, if the Navy SEALs are out there doing something, I bet you there's 10 Navy SEALs games going to come onto the market this year or last year or whatever. So that same, in the same process, we'll get, you know, we're all going to design things because it's popular or whatever. But as Frank said earlier, come on, break the mold. Do something different. Do something exciting and make a difference. Be different. Sometimes difference isn't good either because you show that to a company and then they're going to go, hey, that's way too different. That's not something that we want to do. Again, I'd say this. Please take a look at exploring the fact of going and contacting some companies, and don't be fearful of those companies. I don't think you really have to protect yourself. If you want to do anything, don't go and get a patent. Don't get a, you know, don't do those kind of things. You know, take the rules, mail them to yourself. It's a poor man's way to do it, but that's never going to come up with working with good companies. They're not going to try to mess you up.
Yeah, and let me talk a little bit about that. I mean, you can, speaking from the perspective of when we were a game publisher, we published most of our stuff was in-house, but we published some out-of-house designs. Most game publishers are not starved for ideas. So it's not like they, oh boy, if only we had an idea for a game. You have rafts of ideas that can't all fit on your production schedule. You can't get all the games done you want to do. So what a publisher is looking for is an already developed, finished product that they can publish that way. If somebody's just got an idea, well, yeah, fine. You know, but we got ideas of our own. The second thing to say is that if you're so suspicious of a company that they will rip you off, don't show them the thing because there's lots of ways of ripping you off other than stealing your idea. They can cheat on your royalties. They cannot, you know, they can do all sorts of things. If you think that the company is not trustworthy, then don't even initiate the action with them. You kind of need to have a certain level of trust when you're dealing with publishers, right. And you can't really. There's no real way to protect yourself against, you know, the kind of low-level theft of intellectual property you're talking about there, because you just, you know, for a variety of reasons. There's some interesting things in copyright laws that no one likes to talk about in the game business, but you basically can't copyright game mechanics. Mm-hmm. You know, what's that? You can copyright unique expression, but you can patent some things, but even that's kind of, I think that's kind of foggy, but I'm not an attorney. I'm not an intellectual property attorney. Those guys, they get a lot of money now. They used to not get hardly any money at all because they were so weird. But now it's gotten to be big business, you know. So now there's lots of guys who are making a lot of money as IP attorneys. So you might want to talk to them. But Like, you're going to probably pay a lot of money just to do a good
idea. Don't do that. Just don't do that. It's not worthwhile.
Yeah.
It's not worthwhile. Yeah. Spend your time designing the game. Don't spend your time worrying about...
Yeah, I was just saying, if you have a finished product and you put the manual and you mail it to people, then you go into
your trivia,
they can't steal your game.
It's very different.
You can help them and destroy them.
When you say you can't, a tough... What I'm saying is, your best protection is to deal with companies that you've got to do some work. And one of the things, you got to do some work in research and everything. One of the things you got to do is kind of look at who you want to deal with.
Right.
I'm writing fiction now, and you can't protect yourself by putting you can put copyrights in, but basically what you do if you do all sorts of elaborate stuff with a book publisher. Is convince them that you're a kook and they don't even want to look at your manuscript. You kind of have to deal with publishers that you trust, to deal honestly with you.
Right. Yep.
And that means doing some research sometime to make sure that that's a publisher you want to work with.
Right. Anybody else have a question?
All right. Well, thank you for coming.